hopeless. You will find your way. To Zurich, added the patient. To Zurich, agreed the doctor. Here, I've wrapped some things together for you in this oilcloth. Strap it around your waist. What is it? All the money I have. Some 2,000 francs. It's not much, but it will help you get started. And my passport, for whatever good it will do. We're about the same age, and it's 8 years old. People change. Don't let anyone study it. It's merely an official paper. What will you do? I won't ever need it if I don't hear from you. You're a decent man. I think you are too, as I've known you. But then I didn't know you before, so I can't vouch for that man. I wish I could, but there's no way I can. The man leaned against the railing, watching the light of Ile de Port-Noir recede in the distance. The fishing boat was heading into darkness, as he had plunged into darkness nearly 5 months ago. As he was plunging into another darkness now. Chapter 3 There were no lights on the coast of France. Only the wash of the dying moon outlined the rocky shore. They were 200 yards from land, the fishing boat bobbing gently in the cross currents of the inlet. The captain pointed over the side. There's a small stretch of beach between those two clusters of rock. It's not much, but you'll reach it if you swim to the right. We can drift in another 30-40 feet, no more than that. Only a minute or two. You're doing more than I expected. I thank you for that. No need to. I pay my debts. And I'm one? Very much so. The doctor in Port-Noir sewed up 3 of my crew after that madness 5 months ago. You weren't the only one brought in, you know. The storm? You know me? You were chalk white on the table. But I don't know you, and I don't want to know you. I had no money then, no catch. The doctor said I could pay when my circumstances were better. You're my payment. I need papers, said the man, sensing a source of help. I need a passport altered. Why speak to me? Asked the captain. I said I would put a package over the side north of La Ciotat. That's all I said. You wouldn't have said that if you weren't capable of other things. I will not take you into Marseille. I will not risk the patrol boats. The Sûreté has squadrons all over the harbor. The narcotics teams are maniacs. You pay them, or you pay 20 years in a cell. Which means I can get papers in Marseille, and you can help me. I did not say that. Yes, you did. I need a service, and that service can be found in a place where you won't take me. Still, the service is there. You said it. Said what? That you'll talk to me in Marseille, if I can get there without you. Just tell me where. The skipper of the fishing boat studied the patient's face. The decision was not made lightly, but it was made. There's a café on Rue Saracen, south of Old Harbor, Le Bouc de Mer. I'll be there tonight between 9 and 11. You'll need money, some of it in advance. How much? That's between you and the man you speak with. I've got to have an idea. It's cheaper if you have a document to work with. Otherwise, one has to be stolen. I told you. I've got one. The captain shrugged. 1,500? 2,000 francs? Are we wasting time? The patient thought of the oilcloth packet strapped to his waist. Bankruptcy lay in Marseille, but so did an altered passport. A passport to Zurich. I'll handle it, he said, not knowing why he sounded so confident. Tonight, then. The captain peered at the dimly lit shoreline. This is as far as we can drift. You're on your own now. Remember, if we don't meet in Marseille, you've never seen me and I've never seen you. None of my crew has seen you either. I'll be there. La Boucle de Mer, Rue Sarasin, south of Old Harbor. In God's hands, said the skipper, signaling a crewman at the wheel. The engines rumbled beneath the boat. By the way, the clientele at Le Bouc are not used to the Parisian dialect. I'd rough it up if I were you. Thanks for the advice, said the patient as he swung his legs over the gunwale and lowered himself into the water. He held his knapsack above the surface, legs scissoring to stay afloat. See you tonight, he added in a louder voice, looking up at the black hull of the fishing boat. There was no one there. The captain had left the railing. The only sounds were the slapping of the waves against the wood and the muffled acceleration of the engines. You're on your own now. He shivered and spun in the cold water, angling his body toward the shore, remembering to sidestroke to his right, to head for a cluster of rocks on the right. If the captain knew what he was talking about, the current would take him into the unseen beach. It did. He could feel the undertow pulling his bare feet into the sand, making the last 30 yards the most difficult to cross. But the canvas knapsack was relatively dry, still held above the breaking waves. Minutes later he was sitting on a dune of wild grass, the tall reeds bending with the offshore breezes, the first rays of morning intruding on the night sky. The sun would be up in an hour. He would have to move with it. He opened the knapsack and took out a pair of boots and heavy socks, along with rolled-up trousers and a coarse denim shirt. Somewhere in his past he had learned to pack with an economy of space. The knapsack contained far more than an observer might think. Where had he learned that? Why? The questions never stopped. He got up and took off the British walking shorts he had accepted from Washburn. He stretched them across the reeds of grass to dry. He could discard nothing. He removed his undershirt and did the same. Standing there naked on the dune, he felt an odd sense of exhilaration mingled with a hollow pain in the middle of his stomach. The pain was fear, he knew that. He understood the exhilaration, too. He had passed his first test. He had trusted an instinct, perhaps a compulsion, and had known what to say and how to respond. An hour ago he was without an immediate destination, knowing only that Zurich was his objective, but knowing too that there were borders to cross, official eyes to satisfy. The 8-year-old passport was so obviously not his own that even the dullest immigration clerk would spot the fact. And even if he managed to cross into Switzerland with it, he had to get out. With each move, the odds of his being detained were multiplied. He could not permit that. Not now. Not until he knew more. The answers were in Zurich. He had to travel freely, and he had honed in on a captain of a fishing boat to make that possible. You are not helpless. You will find your way. Before the day was over, he would make a connection to have Washburn's passport altered by a professional, transformed into a license to travel. It was the first concrete step, but before it was taken, there was the consideration of money. The 2,000 francs the doctor had given him were inadequate. They might not even be enough for the passport itself. What good was a license to travel without the means to do so? Money. He had to get money. He had to think about that. He shook out the clothes he had taken from the knapsack, put them on, and shoved his feet into the boots. Then he lay down on the sand, staring at the sky, which progressively grew brighter. The day was being born, and so was he. He walked the narrow stone streets of La Ciotat, going into the shops as much to converse with the clerks as anything else. It was an odd sensation to be part of the human traffic, not an unknown derelict dragged from the sea. He remembered the captain's advice and gutturalized his French, allowing him to be accepted as an unremarkable stranger passing through town. Money. There was a section of La Ciotat that apparently catered to a wealthy clientele. The shops were cleaner and the merchandise more expensive, the fish fresher and the meat several cuts above that in the main shopping area. Even the vegetables glistened. many exotic, imported from North Africa and the Mideast. The area held a touch of Paris or Nice set down on the fringes of a routinely middle-class coastal community. A small cafe, its entrance at the end of a flagstone path, stood separated from the shops on either side by a manicured lawn. Money. He walked into a butcher's shop, aware that the owner's appraisal of him was not positive, nor the glance friendly. The man was waiting on a middle-aged couple, who from their speech and manner were domestics at an outlying estate. They were precise, curt, and demanding. "The veal last week was barely passable," said the woman. "Do better this time, or I'll be forced to order from Marseille." "And the other evening," added the man, "the Marquis mentioned to me that the chops of lamb were much too thin. I repeat, a full inch and a quarter." The owner sighed and shrugged, uttering obsequious phrases of apology and assurance. The woman turned to her escort, her voice no less commanding than it was to the butcher. "Wait for the packages and put them in the car. I'll be at the grocer's. Meet me there." "Of course, my dear." The woman left, a pigeon in search of further seeds of conflict. The moment she was out the door, her husband turned to the shop owner, his demeanor entirely different. Gone was the arrogance. A grin appeared. "Just your average day, Marcel," he said, taking a pack of cigarettes from his pocket. "Seen better, seen worse. Was the chops really too thin?" "My God, no. When was he last able to tell? But she feels better if I complain, you know that. Where is the Marquis of the Dung Heap now? Drunk next door, waiting for the whore from Toulon? I'll come down later this afternoon, pick him up, and sneak him past the Marquis into the stables. He won't be able to drive his car by then. He uses Jean-Pierre's room above the kitchen, you know." "I've heard." At the mention of the name Jean-Pierre, Washburn's patient turned from the display case of poultry. It was an automatic reflex, but the movement only served to remind the butcher of his presence. "What is it? What do you want?" It was time to de-gutturalize his French. "You were recommended by friends in Nice," said the patient, his accent more befitting the Quai d'Orsay than Le Bouc de Mer. "Oh?" The shop owner made an immediate reappraisal. Among his clientele, especially the younger ones, there were those who preferred to dress in opposition to their status. The common Basque shirt was even fashionable these days. "You're new here, sir?" "My boat's in for repairs. We won't be able to reach Marseille this afternoon." "May I be of service?" The patient laughed. "You may be to the chef. I wouldn't dare presume. He'll be around later, and I do have some influence." The butcher and his friend laughed. "I would think so, sir," said the shop owner. "I'll need a dozen ducklings and, say, 18 Chateaubriands." "Of course." "Good. I'll send our master of the galley directly to you." The patient turned to the middle-aged man. "By the way, I couldn't help overhearing. No, please don't be concerned. The Marquis wouldn't be that jackass damois, would he? I think someone told me he lived around here." "Oh, no, sir," replied the servant. "I don't know the Marquis d'Amboise. I was referring to the Marquis de Chamfort. A fine gentleman, sir, but he has problems. A difficult marriage, sir. Very difficult. It's no secret." "Chamfort? Yes, I think we've met. Rather short fellow, isn't he?" "No, sir. Quite tall, actually. About your size, I'd say."
"Really?"
The patient learned the various entrances and inside staircases of the two-story café quickly, a produce delivery man from Roquevert unsure of his new route. There were two sets of steps that led to the second floor, one from the kitchen, the other just beyond the front entrance in the small foyer. This was the staircase used by patrons going to the upstairs washrooms. There was also a window through which an interested party outside could see anyone who used this particular staircase, and the patient was sure that if he waited long enough, he would see two people doing so. They would undoubtedly go up separately, neither heading for a washroom, but instead to a bedroom above the kitchen. The patient wondered which of the expensive automobiles parked on the quiet street belonged to the Marquis de Chamfort. Whichever, the middle-aged manservant in the butcher shop did not have to be concerned. His employer would not be driving it. Money. The woman arrived shortly before 1 o'clock. She was a wind-swept blonde, her large breasts stretching the blue silk of her blouse, her long legs tanned, striding gracefully above spiked heels, thighs and fluid hips outlined beneath the tight-fitting white skirt. Chamfort might have problems, but he also had taste. 20 minutes later, he could see the white skirt through the window. The girl was heading upstairs. Less than 60 seconds later, another figure filled the window frame. Dark trousers and a blazer beneath a white face cautiously lurched up the staircase. The patient counted off the minutes. He hoped the Marquis de Chamfort owned a watch. Carrying his canvas knapsack as unobtrusively as possible by the straps, the patient walked down the flagstone path to the entrance of the restaurant. Inside, he turned left in the foyer, excusing himself past an elderly man trudging up the staircase, reached the second floor and turned left again down a long corridor that led toward the rear of the building, above the kitchen. He passed the washrooms and came to a closed door at the end of the narrow hallway where he stood motionless, his back pressed into the wall. He turned his head and waited for the elderly man to reach the washroom door and push it open while unzipping his trousers. The patient, instinctively, without thinking really, raised the soft knapsack and placed it against the center of the door panel. He held it securely in place with his outstretched arms, stepped back, and in one swift movement crashed his left shoulder into the canvas, dropping his right hand as the door sprang open, gripping the edge before the door could smash into a wall. No one below in the restaurant could have heard the muted forced entry.
Nom de Dieu, she shrieked. Qui est-ce?
Silence. The Marquis de Chamfort spun off the naked body of the blonde woman, sprawling over the edge of the bed onto the floor. He was a sight from a comic opera. Still wearing his starched shirt, the tie knotted in place, and on his feet black silk, knee-length socks. But that was all he wore. The woman grabbed the covers, doing her best to lessen the indelicacy of the moment. The patient issued his commands swiftly. Don't raise your voices. No one will be hurt if you do exactly as I say.
My wife hired you, cried Chamfort,
his words slurred, his eyes barely in focus.
I'll pay you more.
That's a beginning, answered Dr. Washburn's patient. Take off your shirt and tie. Also the socks. He saw the glistening gold band around the Marquis's wrist. And the watch. Several minutes later, the transformation was complete. The Marquis's clothes were not a perfect fit, but no one could deny the quality of the cloth or the original tailoring. Two, the watch was a Girard Perregaux, and Chamfort's billfold contained over 13,000 francs. The car keys were also impressive. They were set in monogrammed heads of sterling silver.
For the love of God, give me your clothes, said the Marquis,
the implausibility of his predicament penetrating the haze of alcohol. I'm sorry, but I can't do that, replied the intruder, gathering up both his own clothes and those of the blonde woman.
You can't take mine, she yelled.
I told you to keep your voice down.
All right, she continued. But you can't.
Yes, I can. The patient looked around the room. There was a telephone on a desk by a window. He crossed to it and yanked the cord out of the socket. Now, no one will disturb you, he added, picking up the knapsack.
You won't go free, you know, snapped Chamfort. You won't get away with this. The police will find you.
The police? Asked the intruder. Do you really think you should call the police? A formal report will have to be made, the circumstances described. I'm not so sure that's such a good idea. I think you'd be better off waiting for that fellow to pick you up later this afternoon. I heard him say he was going to get you past the Marquise into the stables. All things considered, I honestly believe that's what you should do. I'm sure you can come up with a better story than what really happened here. I won't contradict you. The unknown thief left the room, closing the damaged door behind him. You are not helpless. You will find your way. So far he had, and it was a little frightening. What had Washburn said? That his skills and talents would come back? But I don't think you'll ever be able to relate them to anything in your past. The past. What kind of past was it that produced the skills he had displayed during the past 24 hours? Where had he learned to maim and cripple with lunging feet and fingers entwined into hammers? How did he know precisely where to deliver the blows? Who had taught him to play upon the criminal mind, provoking and evoking a reluctant commitment? How did he zero in so quickly on mere implications, convinced beyond doubt that his instincts were right? Where had he learned to discern instant extortion in a casual conversation overheard in a butcher shop? More to the point, perhaps, was the simple decision to carry out the crime. My God, how could he? The more you fight it, the more you crucify yourself, the worse it will be. He concentrated on the road and on the mahogany dashboard of the Marquis de Chamfort's Jaguar. The array of instruments was not familiar. His past did not include extensive experience with such cars. He supposed that told him something. In less than an hour, he crossed a bridge over a wide canal and knew he had reached Marseille. Small square houses of stone, angling like blocks up from the water. Narrow streets and walls everywhere. The outskirts of the old harbor. He knew it all. And yet he did not know it. High in the distance, silhouetted on one of the surrounding hills, were the outlines of a cathedral, a statue of the Virgin seen clearly atop its steeple. Notre Dame de la Garde. The name came to him. He had seen it before. And yet, he had not seen it. Oh, Christ, stop it. Within minutes, he was in the pulsing center of the city, driving along the crowded Canebière, with its proliferation of expensive shops, the rays of the afternoon sun bouncing off expanses of tinted glass on either side, and on either side enormous sidewalk cafes. He turned left toward the harbor, passing warehouses and small factories and fenced-off lots that contained automobiles prepared for transport north to the showrooms of Saint-Étienne, Lyon, and Paris, and to points south across the Mediterranean. Instinct. Follow instinct. For nothing could be disregarded. Every resource had an immediate use. There was value in a rock if it could be thrown, or a vehicle if someone wanted it. He chose a lot where the cars were both new and used, but all expensive. He parked at the curb and got out. Beyond the fence was a small cavern of a garage, mechanics in overalls laconically wandering about carrying tools. He walked casually around inside until he spotted a man in a thin, pinstriped suit whom instinct told him to approach. It took less than 10 minutes. Explanations kept to a minimum, a Jaguar's disappearance to North Africa guaranteed with the filing of engine numbers. The silver monogrammed keys were exchanged for 6,000 francs, roughly one-fifth the value of Chamfort's automobile. Then Dr. Washburn's patient found a taxi and asked to be taken to a pawnbroker, but not an establishment that asked too many questions. The message was clear. This was Marseille. And a half hour later, the gold Girard Perregaux was no longer on his wrist, having been replaced by a Seiko chronograph and 800 francs. Everything had a value in relationship to its practicality. The chronograph was shockproof. The next stop was a medium-sized department store in the southeast section of La Canebière. Clothes were chosen off the racks and shelves, paid for and worn out of the fitting rooms, an ill-fitting dark blazer and trousers left behind. From a display on the floor, he selected a soft leather suitcase, additional garments placed inside with the knapsack. The patient glanced at his new watch. It was nearly 5 o'clock, time to find a comfortable hotel. He had not really slept for several days. He needed to rest before his appointment in the Rue Saracen at a café called Le Bouc de Mer, where arrangements could be made for a more important appointment in Zurich. He lay back on the bed and stared at the ceiling, the wash of the street lamps below causing irregular patterns of light to dance across the smooth white surface. Night had come rapidly to Marseille, and with its arrival a certain sense of freedom came to the patient. It was as if the darkness were a gigantic blanket, blocking out the harsh glare of daylight that revealed too much too quickly. He was learning something else about himself. He was more comfortable in the night. Like a half-starved cat, he would forage better in the darkness. Yet there was a contradiction, and he recognized that, too. During the months in Ile de Pointe-Noire, he had craved the sunlight, hungered for it, waited for it each dawn, wishing only for the darkness to go away. Things were happening to him. He was changing. Things had happened. Events that gave a certain lie to the concept of foraging more successfully at night. 12 hours ago, he was on a fishing boat in the Mediterranean, an objective in mind and 2,000 francs strapped to his waist. 2,000 francs, something less than 500 American dollars according to the daily rate of exchange posted in the hotel lobby. Now he was outfitted with several sets of acceptable clothing and lying on a bed in a reasonably expensive hotel, with something over 23,000 francs in a Louis Vuitton billfold belonging to the Marquis de Chamfort. 23,000 francs. Nearly 6,000 American dollars. Where had he come from that he was able to do the things he did? Stop it. The Rue Sarasin was so ancient that in another city it might have been designated as a landmark thoroughfare, a wide brick alley connecting streets built centuries later. But this was Marseille. Ancient coexisted with old, both uncomfortable with the new. The Rue Sarasin was no more than 200 feet long, frozen in time between the stone walls of waterfront buildings, devoid of streetlights, trapping the mists that rolled off the harbor. It was a back street conducive to brief meetings between men who did not care for their conferences to be observed. The only light and sound came from La Boucle de Mer. The café was situated roughly in the center of the wide alley, its premises once a 19th-century office building. A number of cubicles had been taken down to allow for a large bar room and tables. An equal number were left standing for less public appointments. These were the waterfront's answer to those private rooms found at restaurants along La Canabière, and as befitting their status, there were curtains but no doors. The patient made his way between the crowded tables, cutting his way through the layers of smoke, excusing himself past lurching fishermen and drunken soldiers and red-faced whores looking for beds to rest in as well as new francs. He peered into a succession of cubicles, a crewman looking for his companions, until he found the captain of the fishing boat. There was another man at the table, thin, pale-faced, narrow eyes peering up like a curious ferret's. "Sit down," said the dour skipper. "I thought you'd be here before this." "You said between 9 and 11. It's 10:45.
"You stretch the time, you can pay for the whiskey."
"Be glad to. Order something decent if they've got it." The thin, pale-faced man smiled. Things were going to be all right. They were. The passport in question was, naturally, one of the most difficult in the world to tamper with, but with great care, equipment, and artistry, it could be done. "How much?"
"These skills and equipment do not come cheap.
2,500 francs.
"When can I have it?" "The care, the artistry, they take time. 3 or 4 days. And that's putting the artist under great pressure. He'll scream at me."
"There's an additional 1,000 francs if I can have it tomorrow."
"At 10 in the morning, said the pale-faced man quickly. "I'll take the abuse."
"And the 1,000? Interrupted the scowling captain. "What did you bring out of Pointe-Noire?
Diamonds?"
"Talent," answered the patient, meaning it, but not understanding it.
"I'll need a photograph," said the connection.
I stopped at an arcade and had this made, replied the patient, taking a small square photograph out of his shirt pocket. With all that expensive equipment, I'm sure you can sharpen it up.
Nice clothes, said the captain, passing the print to the pale-faced man.
Well tailored, agreed the patient. The location of the morning rendezvous was agreed upon, the drinks paid for, and the captain slipped 500 francs under the table. The conference was over. The buyer left the cubicle and started across the crowded, raucous, smoke-layered barroom toward the door. It happened so rapidly, so suddenly, so completely unexpectedly, there was no time to think, only react. The collision was abrupt, casual, but the eyes that stared at him were not casual. They seemed to burst out of their sockets, widening in disbelief, on the edge of hysteria.
Oh, oh my God, no. It cannot.
The man spun in the crowd. The patient lurched forward, clamping his hand down on the man's shoulder. Wait a minute. The man spun again, thrusting the V of his outstretched thumb and fingers up into the patient's wrist, forcing the hand away.
You're dead. You could not have lived.
I lived. What do you know? The face was now contorted. A mass of twisted fury, the eyes squinting, the mouth open, sucking air, baring yellow teeth that took on the appearance of animal's teeth. Suddenly the man pulled out a knife, the snap of its recessed blade heard through the surrounding din. The arm shot forward, the blade an extension of the hand that gripped it, both surging in toward the patient's stomach.
I know I'll finish it, whispered the man.
The patient swung his right forearm down, a pendulum sweeping aside all objects in front of it. He pivoted, lashing his left foot up, his heel plunging into his attacker's pelvic bone.
Chissa!
The echo in his ears was deafening. The man lurched backward into a trio of drinkers as the knife fell to the floor. The weapon was seen. Shouts followed, men converged, fists and hands separating the combatants.
Get out of here! Take your argument somewhere else. We don't want the police in here, you drunken bastards.
The angry, coarse dialects of Marseille rose over the cacophonous sounds of La Boucle de Mer. The patient was hemmed in. He watched as his would-be killer threaded his way through the crowd, holding his groin, forcing a path to the entrance. The heavy door swung open. The man raced into the darkness of Rue Sarrasin. Someone who thought he was dead. Wanted him dead, knew he was alive. Chapter 4. The economy class section of Air France's Caravelle to Zurich was filled to capacity, the narrow seats made more uncomfortable by the turbulence that buffeted the plane. A baby was screaming in its mother's arms. Other children whimpered, swallowing cries of fear as parents smiled with tentative reassurances they did not feel. Most of the remaining passengers were silent, a few drinking their whiskey more rapidly than obviously was normal. Fewer still were forcing laughter from tight throats, false bravados that emphasized their insecurity rather than disguising it. A terrible flight was many things to many people, but none escaped the essential thoughts of terror. When man encased himself in a metal tube 30,000 feet above the ground, he was vulnerable. With one elongated, screaming dive, he could be plummeting downward into the earth. And there were fundamental questions that accompanied the essential terror. What thoughts would go through one's mind at such a time? How would one react? The patient tried to find out. It was important to him. He sat next to the window, his eyes on the aircraft's wing, watching the broad expanse of metal bend and vibrate under the brutalizing impact of the winds. The currents were clashing against one another, pounding the man-made tube into a kind of submission, warning the microscopic pretenders that they were no match for the vast infirmities of nature. 1 ounce of pressure beyond the flex tolerance and the wing would crack, the lift-sustaining limb torn from its tubular body, shredded into the winds. 1 burst of rivets and there would be an explosion, the screaming plunge to follow. What would he do? What would he think? Other than the uncontrollable fear of dying and oblivion, would there be anything else? That's what he had to concentrate on. That was the projection Washburn kept emphasizing in Port Noir. The doctor's words came back to him.
Whenever you observe a stress situation, and you have the time, do your damnedest to project yourself into it. Associate as freely as you can. Let words and images fill your mind. In them you may find clues.
The patient continued to stare out the window, consciously trying to raise his unconscious, fixing his eyes on the natural violence beyond the glass, distilling the movement, silently doing his damnedest to let his reactions give rise to words and images. They came, slowly. There was the darkness again, and the sound of rushing wind, ear-shattering, continuous, growing in volume until he thought his head would burst. His head. The winds were lashing the left side of his head and face, burning his skin, forcing him to raise his left shoulder for protection. Left shoulder. Left arm. His arm was raised, the gloved fingers of his left hand gripping a straight edge of metal, his right holding it. A strap. He was holding on to a strap, waiting for something. A signal. A flashing light, or a tap on the shoulder, or both. A signal. It came. He plunged into the darkness, into the void, his body tumbling, twisting, swept away into the night sky. He had parachuted.
Et vous malade?
His insane reverie was broken. The nervous passenger next to him had touched his left arm, which was raised, the fingers of his hand spread as if resisting, rigid in their locked position. Across his chest, his right forearm was pressed into the cloth of his jacket, his right hand gripping the lapel, bunching the fabric, and on his forehead were rivulets of sweat.
It had happened.
The something else had come briefly, insanely into focus.
Pardon, he said, lowering his arms. Un mauvais rêve, he added meaninglessly.
There was a break in the weather. The caravel stabilized. The smiles on the harried stewardess's faces became genuine again. Full service was resumed as embarrassed passengers glanced at one another. The patient observed his surroundings but reached no conclusions. He was consumed by the images and the sounds that had been so clearly defined in his mind's eye and ear. He had hurled himself from a plane, at night, signals and metal and straps intrinsic to his leap. He had parachuted. Where? Why? Stop crucifying yourself. If for no other reason than to take his thoughts away from the madness, he reached into his breast pocket, pulled out the altered passport, and opened it. As might be expected, the name Washburn had been retained. It was common enough, and its owner had explained that there were no flags out for it. The Jeffrey R., however, had been changed to George P., the eliminations and spaceline blockage expertly accomplished. The photographic insertion was expert, too. It no longer resembled a cheap print from a machine in an amusement arcade. The identification numbers, of course, were entirely different, guaranteed not to cause an alarm in an immigration computer. At least, up until the moment the bearer submitted the passport for its first inspection. From that time on, it was the buyer's responsibility. One paid as much for this guarantee as he did for the artistry and the equipment, for it required connections within Interpol and the immigration clearinghouses. Customs officials, computer specialists, and clerks throughout the European border networks were paid on a regular basis for this vital information. They rarely made mistakes. If and when they did, the loss of an eye or an arm was not out of the question. Such were the brokers of false papers. George P. Washburn. He was not comfortable with the name. The owner of the unaltered original had instructed him too well in the basics of projection and association. George P. was a sidestep from Jeffrey R., a man who had been eaten away by a compulsion that had its roots in escape. Escape from identity. That was the last thing the patient wanted. He wanted more than his life to know who he was. Or did he? No matter. The answer was in Zurich. In Zurich, there was, Mesdames et Messieurs, nous commençons notre descente pour l'aéroport de Zurich. He knew the name of the hotel, Carillon du Lac. He had given it to the taxi driver without thinking. Had he read it somewhere? Had the name been one of those listed in the Welcome to Zurich folders placed in the elasticized pockets in front of his seat in the plane? No. He knew the lobby. The heavy, dark, polished wood was familiar, somehow, and the huge plate glass windows that looked out over Lake Zurich. He had been here before. He had stood where he was standing now, in front of the marble-topped counter, a long time ago. It was all confirmed by the words spoken by the clerk behind the desk. They had the impact of an explosion. It's good to see you again, sir. It's been quite a while since your last visit. Has it? How long? Why don't you call me by my name? For God's sake, I don't know you. I don't know me. Help me. Please help me. I guess it has, he said. Do me a favor, will you? I sprained my hand. It's difficult to write. Could you fill in the registration and I'll do my damnedest to sign it? The patient held his breath. Suppose the polite man behind the counter asked him to repeat his name, or the spelling of his name. Of course. The clerk turned the card around and wrote, Would you care to see the hotel doctor? Later, perhaps. Not now. The clerk continued writing, then lifted up the card, reversing it for the guest's signature. Mr. J. Bourne, New York, New York, USA. He stared at it, transfixed, mesmerized by the letters. He had a name, part of a name, and a country as well as a city of residence. J. Bourne. John? James? Joseph? What did the J stand for? Is something wrong, Herr Bourne? Asked the clerk. Wrong? No, not at all. He picked up the pen, remembering to feign discomfort. Would he be expected to write out a first name? No. He would sign exactly as the clerk had printed. Mr. J. Bourne. He wrote the name as naturally as he could, letting his mind fall free, allowing whatever thoughts or images that might be triggered come through. None did. He was merely signing an unfamiliar name. He felt nothing. You had me worried, mein Herr, said the clerk. I thought perhaps I'd made a mistake. It's been a busy week, a busier day. But then I was quite certain. And if he had made a mistake, Mr. J. Bourne of New York City, USA, did not care to think about the possibility. It never occurred to me to question your memory. Herr Stossel, replied the patient, glancing up at the on-duty sign on the left wall of the counter. The man behind the desk was the Carillon du Lac's assistant manager. You're most kind. The assistant manager leaned forward. I assume you'll require the usual conditions of your stay with us. Some may have changed, said J. Bourne. How did you understand them before? Whoever telephones or inquires at the desk is to be told you're out of the hotel, whereupon you're to be informed immediately. The only exception is your firm in New York, the Treadstone 71 Corporation, if I remember correctly. Another name. One he could trace with an overseas call. Fragmentary shapes were falling into place. The exhilaration began to return. That'll do. I won't forget your efficiency. This is Zurich, replied the polite man, shrugging. You've always been exceedingly generous, Herr Bourne. Page, hier, Herr Bitte. As the patient followed the page into the elevator, several things were clearer. He had a name, and he understood why that name came so quickly to the Carillon du Lac's assistant manager. He had a country and a city and a firm that employed him. Had employed him, at any rate. And whenever he came to Zurich, certain precautions were implemented to protect him from unexpected or unwanted visitors. That was what he could not understand. One either protected oneself thoroughly, or one did not bother to protect oneself at all. Where was any real advantage in a screening process that was so loose, so vulnerable to penetration? It struck him as second-rate, without value, as if a small child were playing hide-and-seek. Where am I? Try and find me. I'll say something out loud and give you a hint. It was not professional, and if he had learned anything about himself during the past 48 hours, it was that he was a professional. Of what, he had no idea, but the status was not debatable. The voice of the New York operator faded sporadically over the line. Her conclusion, however, was irritatingly clear and final. There's no listing for any such company, sir. I've checked the latest directories as well as the private telephones, and there's no Treadstone Corporation, and nothing even resembling Treadstone with numbers following the name. Perhaps they were dropped to shorten. There's no firm or company with that name, sir. I repeat, if you have a first or second name, or the type of business the firm's engaged in, I might be of further help. I don't. Only the name. Treadstone 71, New York City. It's an odd name, sir. I'm sure if there were a listing, it would be a simple matter to find it. I'm sorry. Thanks very much for your trouble, said Jay Bourne, replacing the phone. It was pointless to go on. The name was a code of some sort, words relayed by a caller that gained him access to a hotel guest not so readily accessible. And the words could be used by anyone regardless of where he had placed the call. Therefore, the location of New York might well be meaningless. According to an operator, 5,000 miles away, it was. The patient walked to the bureau where he had placed the Louis Vuitton billfold and the Seiko chronograph. He put the billfold in his pocket and the watch on his wrist. He looked in the mirror and spoke quietly. You are Jay Bourne. Citizen of the United States, resident of New York City, and it's entirely possible that the numbers 07, 1712, 014, 260 are the most important things in your life. The sun was bright, filtering through the trees along the elegant Bahnhofstrasse, bouncing off the windows of the shops and creating blocks of shadows where the great banks intruded on its rays. It was a street where solidity and money, security and arrogance, determination and a touch of frivolity all coexisted, and Dr. Washburn's patient had walked along its pavements before. He strolled into the Berkeleyplatz, the square that overlooked the Zürichsee, with its numerous quays along the waterfront, bordered by gardens that in the heat of summer became circles of bursting flowers. He could picture them in his mind's eye. Images were coming to him, but no thoughts, no memories. He doubled back into the Bahnhofstrasse, instinctively knowing that the Gemeinschaft Bank was a nearby building of off-white stone. It had been on the opposite side of the street on which he had just walked. He had passed it deliberately. He approached the heavy glass doors and pushed the center plate forward. The right-hand door swung open easily, and he was standing on a floor of brown marble. He had stood on it before, but the image was not as strong as others. He had the uncomfortable feeling that the Gemeinschaft was to be avoided. It was not to be avoided now. "Bonjour, monsieur. Vous désirez?" The man asking the question was dressed in a cutaway, the red boutonniere, his symbol of authority. The use of French was explained by the client's clothes. Even the subordinate gnomes of Zurich were observant. "I have personal and confidential business to discuss," replied Jay Bourne in English, once again mildly startled by the words he spoke so naturally. The reason for the English was twofold. He wanted to watch the gnome's expression at his error, and he wanted no possible misinterpretation of anything said during the next hour. "Pardon, sir," said the man, his eyebrows arched slightly, studying the client's topcoat.
The elevator to your left, second floor. The receptionist will assist you.
The receptionist referred to was a middle-aged man with close-cropped hair and tortoiseshell glasses. His expression was set, his eyes rigidly curious.
"Do you currently have personal and confidential business with us, sir?" he asked, repeating the new arrival's words.
"I do." "Your signature, please," said the official, holding out a sheet of Gemeinschaft stationery with two blank lines centered in the middle of the page. The client understood. No name was required.
"The handwritten numbers take the place of a name. They constitute the signature of the account holder. Standard procedure.
Washburn." The patient wrote out the numbers, relaxing his hand so the writing would be free. He handed the stationery back to the receptionist, who studied it, rose from the chair, and gestured to a row of narrow doors with frosted glass panels.
"If you wait in the fourth room, sir, someone will be with you shortly."
"The fourth room?"
"The fourth door from the left. It will lock automatically."
"Is that necessary?" The receptionist glanced at him, startled.
"It is in line with your own request, sir," he said politely, an undertone of surprise beneath his courtesy. "This is a 3-0 account. It's customary at the Gemeinschaft for holders of such accounts to telephone in advance so that a private entrance can be made available."
"I know that," lied Washburn's patient with a casualness he did not feel. "It's just that I'm in a hurry."
"I'll convey that to verifications, sir."
"Verifications?" Mr. J. Bourne of New York City, USA, could not help himself. The word had the sound of an alarm.
"Signature verifications, sir."
The man adjusted his glasses. The movement covered is taking a step nearer his desk, his lower hand inches from a console.
"I suggest you wait in room 4, sir."
The suggestion was not a request. It was an order, the command in the Praetorian's eyes. "Why not? Just tell them to hurry, will you?" The patient crossed to the fourth door, opened it, and walked inside. The door closed automatically. He could hear the click of the lock. J. Bourne looked at the frosted panel. It was no simple pane of glass, for there was a network of thin wires webbed beneath the surface. Undoubtedly, if cracked, an alarm would be triggered. He was in a cell, waiting to be summoned. The rest of the small room was paneled and furnished tastefully, two leather armchairs next to one another, across from a miniature couch flanked by antique tables. At the opposite end was a second door, startling in its contrast. It was made of gray steel. Up-to-date magazines and newspapers in three languages were on the tables. The patient sat down and picked up the Paris edition of the Herald Tribune. He read the printed words but absorbed nothing. The summons would come any moment now. His mind was consumed by thoughts of maneuver. Maneuver without memory, only by instinct. Finally, the steel door opened, revealing a tall, slender man with aquiline features and meticulously groomed gray hair. His face was patrician, eager to serve an equal who needed his expertise. He extended his hand, his English refined, mellifluous under his Swiss intonation.
"So very pleased to meet you. Forgive the delay. It was rather humorous, in fact."
"In what way?"
"I'm afraid you rather startled, Herr Koenig. It's not often a 3-0 account arrives without prior notice. He's quite set in his ways, you know. The unusual ruins his day. On the other hand, it generally makes mine more pleasant. I'm Walther Apfel. Please, come in."
The bank officer released the patient's hand and gestured toward the steel door. The room beyond was a V-shaped extension of the cell. Dark paneling, heavy, comfortable furniture, and a wide desk that stood in front of a wider window overlooking the Bahnhofstrasse.
"I'm sorry I upset him," said J. Bourne. "It's just that I have very little time." "Yes, he relayed that."
Apfel walked around the desk, nodding at the leather armchair in front.
"Do sit down. One or two formalities, and we can discuss the business at hand."
Both men sat. The instant they did so, the bank officer picked up a white clipboard and leaned across his desk, handing it to the Gemeinschaft client. Secured in place was another sheet of stationery, but instead of two blank lines, there were 10, starting below the letterhead and extending to within an inch of the bottom border.
Your signature, please. A minimum of 5 will be sufficient.
I don't understand. I just did this.
And very successfully.
Verification confirmed it. Then why again?
A signature can be practiced to the point where a single rendition is acceptable. However, successive repetitions will result in flaws if it's not authentic. A graphological scanner will pick them up instantly.
But then I'm sure that's no concern of yours. Apfel smiled as he placed a pen at the edge of the desk.
Nor of mine, frankly, but Koenig insists.
He's a cautious man, said the patient, taking the pen and starting to write. He had begun the 4th set when the banker stopped him.
That will do. The rest really is a waste of time.
Apfel held out his hand for the clipboard.
Verifications said you weren't even a borderline case. Upon receipt of this, the account will be delivered.
He inserted the sheet of paper into the slot of a metal case on the right side of his desk and pressed a button. A shaft of bright light flared and then went out.
This transmits the signatures directly to the scanner, continued the banker. Which, of course, is programmed. Again, frankly, it's all a bit foolish.
No one forewarned of our precautions would consent to the additional signatures if he were an impostor.
Why not?
As long as he'd gone this far, why not chance it?
There is only one entrance to this office. Conversely, one exit.
I'm sure you heard the lock snap shut in the waiting room.
And saw the wire mesh in the glass, added the patient. Then you understand. A certified impostor would be trapped.
Suppose he had a gun.
You don't.
No one searched me.
The elevator did. From 4 different angles. If you had been armed, the machinery would have stopped between the 1st and 2nd floors.
You're all cautious.
We try to be of service.
The telephone rang. Apfel answered.
Yes?
Come in. The banker glanced at his client. Your account file's here. That was quick.
Herr Koenig signed for it several minutes ago. He was merely waiting for the scanner release.
Apfel opened a drawer and took out a ring of keys.
I'm sure he's disappointed. He was quite certain something was amiss.
The steel door opened and the receptionist entered, carrying a black metal container, which he placed on the desk next to a tray that held a bottle of Perrier and 2 glasses.
Are you enjoying your stay in Zurich?
Asked the banker, obviously, to fill in the silence.
Very much so.
My room overlooks the lake. It's a nice view. Very peaceful. Quiet.
Splendid,
said Apfel, pouring a glass of Perrier for his client. Herr Koenig left. The door was closed, and the banker returned to business.
Your account, sir, he said, selecting a key from the ring. May I unlock the case, or would you prefer doing so yourself?
Go ahead. Open it. The banker looked up.
I said unlock, not open. That's not my privilege, nor would I care for the responsibility.
Why not?
In the event your identity is listed, it's not my position to be aware of it.
Suppose I wanted business transacted, money transferred, sent to someone else.
It could be accomplished with your numerical signature on a withdrawal form.
Or sent to another bank, outside of Switzerland?
For me. Then a name would be required. Under those circumstances, an identity would be both my responsibility and my privilege.
Open it. The bank officer did so. Dr. Washburn's patient held his breath, a sharp pain forming in the pit of his stomach. Apfel took out a sheaf of statements held together by an outsized paperclip. His banker's eyes strayed to the right-hand column of the top pages, his banker's expression unchanged, but not totally. His lower lip stretched ever so slightly, creasing the corner of his mouth. He leaned forward and handed the pages to their owner. Beneath the Gemeinschaft letterhead, the typewritten words were in English, the obvious language of the client. Account: 07171204620. Name: restricted to legal instructions and owner. Access: sealed under separate cover. Current funds on deposit: 7,500,000 francs. The patient exhaled slowly, staring at the figure. Whatever he thought he was prepared for, nothing prepared him for this. It was as frightening as anything he had experienced during the past 5 months. Roughly calculated, the amount was over $5 million. $5 million? How? Why? Controlling the start of a tremble in his hand, he leafed through the statements of entry. They were numerous, the sums extraordinary, none less than 300,000 francs, the deposits spaced every 5 to 8 weeks apart, going back 23 months. He reached the bottom statement, the first. It was a transfer from a bank in Singapore and the largest single entry. $2,700,000 converted into 5,175,000 Swiss francs. Beneath the statement, he could feel the outline of a separate envelope, far shorter than the page itself. He lifted up the paper. The envelope was rimmed with a black border, typewritten words on the front. Identity: owner access. Legal restrictions: access. Registered officer: Treadstone 71 Corporation. Bearer will produce written instructions from owner, subject to verifications. "I'd like to check this," said the client.
"It's your property," replied Apfel. "I can assure you it has remained intact."
The patient removed the envelope and turned it over. A Gemeinschaft seal was pressed over the borders of the flap. None of the raised letters had been disturbed. He tore the flap open, took out the card, and read, "Owner: Jason Charles Bourne. Address: unlisted. Citizenship: USA." Jason Charles Bourne. Jason. The J was for Jason. His name was Jason Bourne. The Bourne had meant nothing. The J Bourne still meaningless, but in the combination Jason and Bourne, obscure tumblers locked into place. He could accept it. He did accept it. He was Jason Charles Bourne, American. Yet he could feel his chest pounding. The vibration in his ears was deafening, the pain in his stomach more acute. What was it? Why did he have the feeling that he was plunging into the darkness again, into the black waters again? "Is something wrong?" asked Walther Apfel. "Is something wrong, Herr Bourne?" "No. Everything's fine. My name's Bourne. Jason Bourne." Was he shouting? Whispering? He could not tell. "My privilege to know you, Mr. Bourne. Your identity will remain confidential. You have the word of an officer of the Bank Gemeinschaft." "Thank you. Now I'm afraid I've got to transfer a great deal of this money, and I'll need your help." "Again? My privilege. Whatever assistance or advice I can render, I shall be happy.